Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore. When you purchase your books from the Tattered Cover, you enable us to continue to bring you programming like you're about to enjoy this evening. And this evening, we could not bring this program to you by ourselves. The presentation portion of tonight's event will be an interview conducted by 7 News anchor woman Bertha Lynn. Bertha is a multi-Emmy award-winning journalist who has been inducted into the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Heartland Chapter Silver Circle. She has also been recognized by McGraw-Hill for corporate achievement and the Colorado Association of Black Journalists, which has named its Lifetime Achievement Award for her. And just this month, Bertha was inducted into the Colorado Broadcasting Professionals Hall of Fame. Would you please join me in welcoming Bertha Lynn?
Thank you, Charles.
And some might argue that we would not even be gathered this evening if it weren't for the University of Denver. I'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge to you for all that it does, and particularly for making this evening a success. To introduce our very special guest tonight, I'd like to welcome the Chancellor of the University of Denver, Dr. Robert Coombe.
Good evening, everybody. It's a great pleasure for me to be here with you this evening and an honor for me to introduce one of our most distinguished alumni. At DU, we think of Condi as a brilliant, brilliant daughter of a wonderful DU family. You may know that her family moved to DU in the late 1960s. Her father, John, came to teach history at DU and ultimately became the associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences there. And her mother, Angelina, worked in the admissions office, but also took a raft of courses in art and music and theater. Perhaps that's where the piano comes from. Maybe so. We think of her principally in academic terms, I suppose, as a great mind, a true intellectual, really one of the great minds in our nation today. Of course, she did her undergraduate degree at DU and was absolutely brilliant, finished at the age of 19, did her doctorate in our Graduate School of International Studies, now the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies. And our faculty still remember her, what she was like then, how her mind worked, a truly, truly brilliant person, a true intellectual that chose an academic path. After leaving DU, she headed straight for Stanford and took a job as an assistant professor there. And her stature only grew and was noticed by more and more and more persons, one of whom was Brent Scowcroft, who was at the National Security Agency at that time for President George H.W. Bush, and recruited her away from Stanford to the NSA. Where she became known as one of the United States' really, really great intellectual assets, a true scholar of the Soviet Union at the time. She left to go back to Stanford when the administration changed over, but this time as provost in 1994. I recall that there was this really interesting article that appeared in, I think, the December issue of Time magazine in 1994 that was about the 50 great leaders in this country that were under 40 years of age. And she was one of those. And the article talked about how agile fragile her mind was and what she had done at the NSA, and speculated that surely she would be back in Washington quite soon, perhaps as a congressman or something like that. And it said with some hyperbole that, you know, she could end up being Secretary of State. I don't think anybody knew how rapidly that prediction would come true. Of course, she went back to Washington with the George W. Bush administration, first as National Security Advisor and then as Secretary of State in 2004. But once again, at the end of the Bush administration, she went back to Stanford, where her academic roots are. A true, true intellectual, a great mind. We think of Condi as this marvelous, marvelous mixture of music and art and intellect and ideas and drive that are somehow mixed together, that somehow amplify one another in a single person, an extraordinary, extraordinary person. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome one of the great intellects of our time, one of the great women of our time, one of the great people of our time, Secretary Condoleezza Rice.
Let's get to it. You all have been so patient. But you know, it's a Friday night. Things happen on Friday nights. We had a little communication difficulty, a little transportation difficulty, but she is here. I had complications in my own family. Everybody up the front row was supposed to be all Naveses, all my family. One thing after another kept cropping up. My husband had a conflict. My husband, who's been talking to me about Condoleezza Rice for the past 34 years, seriously, was not able to be here. Otherwise, he would love to have been here.
Oh, you'll take him a book, won't you,
Bertha? Yeah.
All right. Okay. That's good.
He has already taken this away from me. We had to fight to get this, to get a chance to read it. But anyway, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much. It always feels like Denver's on the map when an illustrious visitor like this comes to town, doesn't it? So thank you for being here and finding time. By the way, I really do appreciate the index that you put in the back, because it made it easy to find Larry on pages 67 and 132. I should explain. Can you hear us in the back?
Barely.
Okay, let me move this closer. I should explain that my husband has been talking to me about Condoleezza Rice because her father, the Reverend John Rice, recruited him to come to the University of Denver all those years ago. That's what brought him to Denver, and this is where we met, and the rest is history.
That's
and
right.
Our daughter, our middle child, is sitting down here in front. She was able to make it tonight. So let us begin. Let us begin with education. So many people in our generation, and Dr. Rice and I are of the same generation, are really the first ones to go to college to achieve higher education. But it's really unusual that not only were your parents college educated, your grandparents were college educated.
My grandfather, that's correct.
How rare. Could you please explain how that was possible?
Well, yes. First of all, thanks very much for coming out tonight. And it's great to be back in my home city of Denver. I lived here a long, long time, and so it's great to be back in Denver. And it's great to be with you,
Thank you, Bertha.
You're a wonderful asset to this city and to the nation. So thanks for being here. I just want to tell you a little bit about John Wesley Rice Sr., who was my paternal grandfather. And John Wesley Rice Sr. was a sharecropper's son in Utah. That would be E-U-T-A-W. I'm not kidding. Alabama. And when John Wesley Rice Sr. was about 19 years old, he decided he wanted to get book learning in a college. So he asked people how a colored man could go to college. They told him about Little Stillman College, which was 30 miles away. It was a little Presbyterian school, and they trained colored men. So he saved up his cotton. He went off to Stillman College, and at Stillman College, he finished his first year, and then they said, so how are you going to pay for your second year? And he said, well, I'm out of cotton. They said, well, you're out of luck. And he said, well, how are those boys going to school? They said, well, you see, they want to be Presbyterian ministers, so they have a scholarship. And my grandfather said, you know, that was exactly what I wanted to be. It's exactly what I had in mind. And
And my family has been Presbyterian and college educated ever since. And so Granddaddy Rice was the first to be college educated in our family almost at the turn of the century, which is quite remarkable.
A very creative man.
Yes.
Educated and in the ministry, and that kind of describes the rest of your family as well.
It does. My family was a family for which faith and family and education were everything. And indeed, the messages in my family, but also in our little segregated Black middle-class community of Birmingham, were very strong. Those messages were, we will give you every opportunity. You cannot consider yourself a victim. You may have to be twice as good, and that was said, by the way, as a matter of fact, not a matter for debate. And by the way, we believe that education is your armor against everything bad, because if you're educated, you may not be able to control your circumstances, but you can respond to your circumstances, and you can choose how you will respond to them. And so education was everything, and my parents... not just for me. One of the wonderful things about doing this book was I got to meet students of theirs, colleagues of theirs, Larry Naves, who was one of my father's favorite students, who all said the same thing. But for your parents, or particularly your father, I might not have pushed through in terms of education. My dad was a Presbyterian minister, like his father, an educational evangelist, and there was behind his church a government project called Loveland Village. And Daddy would go door to door in Loveland Village telling the families there, your daughter's smart, and she ought to go to college, and I've got a scholarship for her at Tuskegee. Or your son is smart, and I've got a scholarship for him at Stillman College. And so they were real educational evangelists.
Well, I know that to be a fact, because that is exactly how it played out for my husband, Larry. And he speaks so highly, and has for as long as I've known him, about your dad, and how he was a mentor to him, and he reached out, he reached back, and he pulled up the young people to give them opportunities, even going so far, and we take these things for granted, but even going so far, your dad and your mom having dinners to teach these young people manners, etiquette. Because, you know, we have access to that kind of information now. But if you think back to 1960s Birmingham and what those young people had to endure, and the marches and having hoses sprayed on them and the dogs set upon them for the Children's March, etc., it was a whole different world. And when my husband talks to me and our children about Denver, it's in glowing terms, because when he came here, he thought he had gone to heaven.
Yes.
By comparison to what Birmingham was like.
Yes.
So help people understand what Birmingham was like in those days.
Well, Birmingham, I'm tempted to say, was the best of times and the worst of times. It was the best of times for a middle-class enclave in Birmingham called Titusville, where I grew up. It was a little community. I think there was one lawyer, there was one doctor, and everybody else taught school. And in this little community, the kids were the center of attention. And so we had our own ballet lessons and our own French lessons and indeed our own etiquette lessons. And when I first went to a White House dinner, I was really glad I knew which fork to use. So it all paid off. And we had a sense that we could achieve. Now, that little community of Birmingham produced incredible kids, not just me, but Freeman Hrabowski, who's the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, the current president of the University of Missouri, Kansas City, the first Black woman governor of the International Monetary Fund, a judge who was my father's student, Larry. That community produced a couple of Pulitzer Prize winners, a woman who is actually a professor of medieval studies at George Mason University. So in that sense, it was the best of times, because we were raised with as much love and support as you could possibly imagine. On the other hand, it was Birmingham. the most segregated big city in the whole country, a city known for a man named Eugene Bull Connor. He was the public safety commissioner. He was the fist of Jim Crow. And, of course, George Wallace was its heart and soul in the State House in Alabama. And it was a city where you couldn't go to a restaurant or to a movie theater. It was a city where when you traveled, as we did to New York or to Denver later on, you had to make it all the way to Washington, D.C., or going west to the other side of the Tennessee border in order to stay in a hotel or to eat in a restaurant. So it was a very segregated city. Most of the time, it didn't intrude on your daily life because our parents were so protective. But first it started to intrude because every once in a while something would happen. I tell the story in the book about going to visit Santa Claus at age 5. And you know the drill. You go to see Santa Claus. You stand in line. Little girl, what do you want for Christmas? This particular Santa Claus was taking the little black kids and holding them out here and putting the little white kids on his knee. And I see a number of my friends here who knew my parents, and it won't surprise them that my father, I overheard my father say to my mother, "Angelina, if he does that to Condoleezza, I'm going to pull all that stuff off of him and show him to be the cracker that he is." Well, as you might imagine, little Condoleezza goes forward then with a little trepidation. Who's going to go off here? Daddy, Santa Claus, Daddy, Santa Claus. But Santa Claus must have felt my father's furor because my dad was a big man. He was 6'2", built like a football player. He took me, put me on his knee and said, "Little girl, what will you have for Christmas?" So I said in the book, you know, all's well that ends well, but a racially charged incident around, of all things, Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. That was Birmingham. Mm-hmm.
And you can see that picture, by the way, in the book. The pictures you selected are really telling. Really nicely done. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the difficulties growing up in Birmingham. Let's get back to education. The schools were segregated, but the teachers went to very creative lengths to make sure the students had certain advantages. And the schools played a role greater than just educating the kids. They provided a cultural center
The
community.
That's right. Well, as you can imagine, in a community where you couldn't go to the symphony downtown or even to a movie theater, the schools and the churches became the kind of center of our cultural life. And every school, from elementary school through high school, had an instrumental band. And the great thing was to be able to play in the instrumental band. Now, for me, because I'd played piano from age 3, I read music. Everybody had to read music, by the way. You didn't just play by ear. You had to read music. I got into the instrumental band because I read music. But the problem is you can't play the piano in the instrumental band. So the question became, what would I play? Well, I wanted to play the flute. My father believed a wives' tale that your lips would get out of shape if you played the flute too young, so I couldn't play the flute. So we decided on the Belleier, or the Glockenspiel, and they got me to do it because my dad said, that can be heard above everything else. And at that point, I thought, okay, that's what I'll play. So I played the bells. But those bands and the concerts that they gave and the performances of the historically black college glee clubs like the Fisk Jubilee Singers, we also had our own cultural life. And my mother, who was a very elegant lady who was herself a musician, was teaching in a very poor high school in Birmingham out in Ensley, which was steel country. And she believed in the democratization of the arts. So with those kids, she gave operettas to the music of Liszt. She gave Porgy and Bess with the kids performing. And so the schools and the churches also provided a wonderful cultural life for us.
And didn't people come to those performances dressed to
like
the hilt?
Dressed like they were going to the Metropolitan Opera. It was a big night when one of those performances took place.
And they probably still talk about it to this day. Getting back to the early portions of the book, you spend a lot of time describing your ancestors, various physical traits.
Yes.
I noticed that. Skin coloration, the texture of the hair, cheekbones, the structure of the nose. Why was that so important to you to tell your story?
Well, it's important for people to know that for my grandparents and my parents,
We in the Black community, we're still dealing with what I consider to be one of the deep wounds of our birth defect, national birth defect of slavery and the discrimination that that transpired. The lighter skinned you were, the more aquiline your features were, the straighter your hair was, the better off you were. There were clubs that were said to have a rule. There's a brown, a tan paper sack there, and if you are darker than that paper sack, don't bother to apply. Now, this was within the Black community. Now, fortunately, by the time I was in college and even high school, you know, Black is beautiful and Afro hairstyles, and we'd kind of gotten over that, although I do tell the story that my mother, who was very fair-skinned, her father was had a, we believe, a white father, so she was very fair. She had long, beautiful, straight hair. I also had really long hair, but mine, unlike hers, was this unruly mop. So when I cut it at 16, my father thought I'd given up some social advantage because of the long hair. And so this was somehow one of the scars of the Black community that I thought we need to talk about, because we have a hard time in this country talking about race. And I thought in order to understand my story, you had to understand race.
Okay, interesting. One of the things I noticed also is that you don't use the term in describing yourself, African American. Yeah. You know, we've been everything.
Yes, we
have. Been
yes.
haven't we? We've been colored and
once.
Negro
yes.
and Black and right. African American. I personally kind of like African American.
Yes.
It's as a parent, I decided that that. Just as I'm proud of my mother's side of the family and her being from Italy and my family members being there, and I can refer to a place, I use the term African American so that my children know that on the other side of the family there's also a place that we hearken back to, and ancestors with also a rich cultural heritage, artistry, languages, and so on. But there's a valid reason for not choosing
yes.
that
yes.
and using the term Black. Can you
using
explain
term
that?
Black, yes. Well, first of all, I'm very proud of the African heritage. That's not the issue. But it was a stolen. We were stolen from that heritage. We didn't immigrate from that heritage. And I think African American actually kind of lets us off the hook as Americans, because it mimics an immigrant narrative where Mexican Americans or Chinese Americans or Indian Americans or Italian Americans or Irish Americans came to the United States as immigrants. We came to this country as founding populations, Europeans and Africans, Africans in chains. And together, we built this country from the very beginning, from its earliest times. And so, for me, Black and white is just starker. And it reminds us of what the true root was for the sons and daughters of Africa here to the United States.
Okay, thank you. There is a spot in the book. Well, I'll get to that in a moment. Let me talk about how you've already been president.
Yes, I have.
Did you know that?
I have.
Not just in her mind. She really has already been president. Could you explain?
I was president of the Rice family from age four, actually. My mother voted for me every year, so I knew I was going to win, and there were no term limits. And the president of the family had real responsibility. For instance, if we were leaving for Denver the next day, the president of the family, me, had to call everybody together in a family meeting. We would decide the time of departure, what kind of food we were going to carry, and so forth. The president of the family, when the family had to move, had to call a family meeting so we could decide colors of the paint for the new walls and all of that kind of thing. And in reflecting on this, one of the wonderful things about writing this book is that some of these things I'd not thought much about. What were my parents doing? But I think in retrospect, they were giving me a sense of how to make decisions, how to lead, and they let me do it. I mean, they really gave it real responsibility. So I learned a lot about their ways of parenting in writing this book.
Would you do everything the same way?
Oh, probably not everything. My parents also tried to send me to first grade when I was three. That didn't work out so well. I rebelled on that one, refused to go.
It's Friday. Do you remember what you were doing last Friday? I barely remember. Do you remember what you were doing last Friday?
Barely.
Weren't you meeting with President Obama at the White House?
Yes, of course. Sorry, it's been a long tour.
It says right here.
Yes, it is true. That's right. Was that only last Friday? It only seems like a month ago. Yes. Yes, I was indeed at the White House. President Obama kindly asked me to come and visit with him. It's often the case that presidents will ask former cabinet secretaries, particularly on the foreign policy side, to come back and share views. Foreign policy has to be bipartisan. You know, we all have to care about American interests. We don't all have to agree, but we all have to have a sense that we are defending America's interests and values, and we're doing that without regard to party. And so I was very grateful when he asked me to come, and we had a very nice conversation about foreign policy.
A rather civil conversation, I would assume.
Of course. I knew the president before he became president. He was, as a senator, on the committee that oversaw the State Department, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, so we'd gotten to know each other in that context.
But, Dr. Rice, he beat you to being the first black president.
That's okay.
You don't harbor any resentment?
No, I harbor no resentment, and as a matter of fact, somebody else is going to be the second.
But that still leaves open the opportunity of being the first woman president.
Somebody else is going to do that, too.
Now, I've been on Facebook. I probably am the last person on Earth to go on Facebook. But I've been on your Facebook page recently and have linked it to my Facebook page because I saw something very nice about the civility of a former member of the previous administration not chirping at the current administration. And you were applauded for your civility. Why is that important to you?
Well, we were very fortunate, those of us who serve in government, very fortunate to go there, serve the country for 8 years. In difficult times, I would be the first to say that not everything that we did turned out well. Many things did. History will judge. But I was so proud to serve for those 8 years. But then I was done. There was an election. We have a president who is my president, too. And I know that it is a lot harder in there than it is out here. And I know that when you're in there and especially people who've been in government, are saying, oh, they're doing this wrong and they're doing that wrong, and you think to yourself, well, gee, why didn't you do some of that when you were here? Because it is a lot harder out in here, in there, than it is out here. And so I know the members of this administration well enough that if I have something that I want to say to Hillary Clinton, who I first met when she brought her freshman daughter to Stanford, or to Bob Gates, who's been my colleague since the Bush administration of President George H.W. Bush, I can certainly call them and say it. I don't need to say it to the New York Times.
And they call you.
Let me be very clear. When you're in there, the advice of the person who's left that office, you need to be careful to think that it's overwhelmingly useful, because when you're in, you're making calculations on an hourly basis, and you can't know that from the outside. But I have talked to Bob Gates several times. I have talked to Secretary Clinton several times. I've obviously talked to the president. And when they have something that they want to talk to me about, they know they can call me, too.
Very interesting. Now, it seems odd to be sitting with a former Secretary of State from the administration that took us into wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and have left the country with huge deficits that can be traced to those wars, and not actually be able to discuss that. I know that you have another book coming.
I do.
And we will reserve those questions for the next book.
Well, I will say one thing since you brought
it up. Please.
Look, the country after September 11th faced a lot of very difficult choices. And those of us who were in positions of authority, every day after September 11th was September 12th. You have no idea what it is like to be National Security Advisor on the day that 3,000 people die and people are jumping out of 80-story windows to avoid the inevitable. And of course you're going to see security differently after that. And Afghanistan was always going to be hard. It is the fifth poorest country in the world. If you fly over it, you can see in those high mountains how terrorists hide. But I hope we'll have the patience to help the Afghans build a more decent life. And by the way, at least it's a place now where women are not being executed in soccer stadiums by the Taliban and girls are going to school. That counts for something. And yes, Iraq was a controversial decision. I myself know that we did a lot of things poorly in trying to reconstruct Iraq, not out of malice, but this was a society that was much more broken than we thought. But it may not be popular, but I would take Saddam Hussein out again. Because today, our conversations are different about Iraq, and I think the Iraqis will make their way to democracy. Now, whether you agree or disagree, you know, we made those decisions in a spirit of trying to do what was best for the country. And hopefully in the book that I hope you'll all read that will come after this one, I can talk more about some of the tough decisions that we had to take.
All right. Let's end on a lighter note. I have a portion of the book that I would like to read, unless you would prefer to read.
No. You're the one with the great voice.
Right.
I think you should read.
You talk about family, of course, and your parents, the education, the ministry, and being grounded in faith. And you write about debating theology with your dad.
There's debating with my father, who was a trained theologian when I was four, that he was mispronouncing Job. Didn't he understand that it was Job, not Job?
But further, you say, I always felt that my father wanted me to use my intellect to help build my faith. I was never told to simply accept anything on the face of it, and my constant questions were always engaged. Because my father never made reason and faith enemies of each other, my religious conviction was strengthened. I am grateful for that, because in the many intellectual environs in which I have found myself, I've never suffered the crisis of faith that so many do. I have always believed fully and completely. My challenge has been to avoid complacency in my faith and to remember to struggle with its meaning as my father taught me to do. Can you give us some examples of some intellectual environs where you did not suffer a crisis of faith, where your faith sustained you?
Yes. Well, I'm a university professor. And in universities, because they are the places that both are the guardians of human knowledge and the places that are to expand the realm of human knowledge, and because reason is at the core of the modern university after the Enlightenment, questions of whether or not something that you cannot see, feel, touch, something about which you cannot build an experiment, something about which you cannot reach for hard evidence, is that valid as a truth? And it's natural that in a university that is so much based on reason and evidence and the progression of knowledge, that for many, the answer to that is no. But for me, someone who is deeply faithful and deeply believing in God, I'm also quite aware of how little we really understand of the universe around us. I've always been attracted to the philosopher Piaget, who said that you can understand an intelligence that is beneath you, one that is less intelligent, but you cannot understand an intelligence greater than yourself. And so I'm quite comfortable with life in a place that is devoted to reason and evidence and argumentation and truth born of hard fact, saying I think there are also truths that one accepts on faith, truths that may not be evident,
and truths that, while they cannot be proven, I am quite certain are indeed truths.
What about in your career life? Any examples of where your faith has sustained you?
Oh, my faith sustains me every day. My faith is so much a part of me that it's hard to separate it out. Clearly, in difficult times after 9/11, I think it was very important to me. Abraham Lincoln perhaps said it best. He said, there's that moment when reason no longer explains and you have no choice but to go to your knees, he said. And I think that that is very much the case for many of us. Also, on a personal note, I've lost both my parents. My father, though, was almost 78 when he died, and I somehow, as much as I miss him, feel that he had a complete life. He lived to be an old man, so to speak. My mother died at 61, and she had had breast cancer when I was 15. I was grateful that she lived until I was 30, but she was a young woman when she died, and there's no way to deal with that intellectually. There's no way to deal with that through your brain and through your mind. And I remember sitting, and I describe it in the book, and it's something I've never quite been adequately able to describe. I came back. I didn't make it home before my mother died, and I came home. And I was sitting in her bedroom, and it was almost as if, it was as if all of a sudden I felt something release, a spirit release. And as if she'd somehow waited for that moment, even though she had gone on. And that and my sense of some completion there gave me a moment when suddenly I understood that what the Apostle Paul had meant when he said, the peace that passeth understanding. There is sometimes a peace that is well beyond anything that your intellect can provide. And that, for me, comes from faith.
I think that's a good note on which to end. Thank you so much, Dr. Rice.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.